You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Catherine Kramer. Catherine, thanks so much for being with me today.
Hi, thanks.
So, Catherine, today we're going to talk about your book, Missing History, about the covert education of a child of the great books. Tell me a little bit about this book and how it started, why you began to write the book, Missing History.
Sure. There were a couple of sources for the book, which kind of grew into something else as I started. It was thinking about former teachers of mine, just remembering various eccentric teachers, like a retired English brigadier general who, to teach us Latin, used to take us out on the playing field and have us take sticks for swords and trash can lids for shields and enact battles by Caesar, and a number of teachers like this. And then watching my own child when he was five starting to go through the school system, but sort of a different kind of school. And I remember going to interview his kindergarten teacher and sitting in these little kindergarten chairs and having her tell me that they didn't give grades because they didn't want students to worry about how good they were at something, but just how much they liked it or not and were interested in it. And, you know, I was sitting there in this tiny little chair, squashed in this chair, and I thought, I really almost felt like crying because it just took me back sort of wholesale to those elementary school days of sitting in desks and being afraid of getting the answer right or not. And I wasn't in a school, I mean, I wasn't, you know, it wasn't an English public school. I wasn't punished and things like that. But I just began to think about the fact that this need to get things right is so ingrained in us and so much of what teaching seems to be about. And so those were the two sources that started me writing this book. I guess the other thing I should say is that the title comes from the fact that I'm the child of an academic and grew up in a whole academic atmosphere. So.
And where was that academic? Talk a little bit about where you grew up and where you went to school, because that sounds much more interesting than the school I went to, and you had more inspiring teachers than I did. Where was that, and what school did you go to?
Well, I grew up in Annapolis the first 10 years of my life. My father taught at St. John's College, which is noted for its great books program, where everybody follows this same curriculum of the great books. And I went to a little elementary school that my father and some other St. John's tutors started called the Key School that's still in existence and started with three grades and has now gone up to all the way through high school and is a prep school now. And it was kind of informal in those days. We didn't have lots of money. The school didn't have lots of money, so they would get truckloads of things like building materials and old tires. I remember taking old tires out into the Severn River in Annapolis and trying to build a sandbar and things like that. So it was more informal than a lot of schools. But even so, for whatever reason, because grades were valued, I don't really know, but I remember waking up one time in the middle of the night in second grade and realizing I had forgotten to memorize a poem. And so at 2 in the morning, I got up and sat under this light and tried to memorize Walter de la Mare's The Listener. And then we moved to New Mexico. St. John's opened a second campus there in 1964. And so I went to high school in Santa Fe for the second half of my schooling.
And what was that like there? I would think that was very different. Or was a high school in Santa Fe similar to what you had experienced? I mean, the memorizing poems and just focusing on the great books, as you were just talking about, is sounds almost like education we've heard of in some 19th century schools not 19th century, early 20th century too, but not something that we hear a lot about now. Was the school in Santa Fe
It
very
was
different?
Pretty usual sort of prep school, I think, with the usual subjects. And it was a small private school, and small classes, interested teachers, and I don't really know why I had this feeling of always needing to be right. I don't mean that I was always nervous in schools. It's more in retrospect when I saw how children could be taught differently that I began to think back on my education and that of lots of people I grew up with, and to look at the sources of that sense of discomfort. And I would say, although in a way I kind of located it in the great books program or that way of thinking, the book I know has resonated with people who had quite different sorts of educational backgrounds, which is the sense of what you went to school for.
And what happened with your son and after kindergarten progressed through school, how did that match up with the experience that you had that you described in his talking to his kindergarten teacher?
Well, I think he was very glad that he went to that school for his elementary school years because the way they taught was so different from what he experienced subsequently everywhere he went to. During that time, we were abroad for a year in the Czech Republic, and he went to a Czech school, which was still taught very much along the communist model lines, where the teacher stood in front of the class and everybody sort of repeated everything. And because he didn't know Czech, he was just sitting there most of the time, and the teacher said to the rest of the class, well, you know, you should behave the way that he does because he, look at how polite American children are. And so that was kind of a difficult experience for him. He got bullied, and we switched schools there. And interestingly, because he was uncomfortable, he sort of got headaches, and we went to a doctor, and she actually wrote a prescription for him to change schools, which I thought was just the greatest thing. But then he went to a couple of local high schools and spent his last years in a boarding school. So he sort of ran the gamut of different sorts of levels of education. And I know if he were on this phone call, he'd have lots to say about all of them. So I'm not sure. I think he sort of agrees with my overall assessment of schooling and how differently things could be taught. I do see schools in general as systematically, though not intentionally, kind of hammering out people's curiosity. You see so many kids start school and be curious and eager to learn, and then they're taught they have to do this now. They can't, you know, they can't stop reading something they're really interested in. They have to go do something else, or they think they're not good at math because the way math is taught doesn't work with how they think and things like that. So
that's very interesting. It's changing. I guess the schooling itself seems to be continually changing. I know, you know, my son's in a private school, 16 years old now, and there seems to be this emphasis on, you know, I think what you're saying, not encouraging curiosity as much as they could, but also this whole notion of what it means to participate in the class, a very high emphasis on how and what to say to participate, which is of course something subjective. It's not an academic standard, but that also seems to be in a sense wanting all the kids to turn out the same or act the same, almost like the teacher said, you know, really erroneously to your son, look how incredibly polite and good this boy is, be like him, when all children, you know, in fact, interact with teachers differently and for different reasons.
Yeah.
He wasn't being enormously polite. He was being kind of shy, really, because he didn't understand the language. So it seems that there's some just in the landscape of education in public schools. I mean, I want to talk specifically about your book, but since we're on to your son's education and how he grew up and also where you came from, and both of these things resonate, I suppose, with a lot of our listeners who have different educational experiences, what do you think is happening at this point in in terms of education. Not only the new administration, but what we have now, what we've had for the past decade in terms of public education versus private education, and how do children get a good education? What do you think is valuable? Is it what they're doing now with this kind of ideally allowing people to follow your curiosity, or is that not happening as much as it should?
I don't think it's happening, no. And I think it's going to happen even less under the current people in charge of education. I think a lot of it should just be dismantled. I think, especially in high school, I think elementary schools vary a great deal, and teachers are very challenged in all over the place by all the difficulties that some kids bring to classes, things that have to do with their home situations that the teachers are trying to run interference for. And so that makes it very difficult, too. But I think in high school there's just a sense of great irrelevance for a lot of kids. I think in public schools and private schools, I think in private schools like the more high-toned boarding schools and prep schools and so on, the kids are very motivated because there's this goal of getting into college, and that keeps a lot of them working hard and with 8,000 extracurricular activities so they can have a great application and so on. But I don't know. I think, I teach at a college, and I know that I and others of my colleagues will say to freshmen when they come in, and we'll give them something to read, and they'll say, well, what do you think? And they'll go, well, they're not saying this aloud, but they think, well, what does she mean? What do I think? Like, what sort of thing is she looking for? And I think that's a real shame that you should come out of a secondary education feeling that way, that there is some sort of right answer that you're supposed to find, and then you'll be rewarded. So, we could talk a lot about educational theory and stuff, and this is anecdotal, but I do think that it's not working that well. And
would you say that's even, that certainly makes sense in terms of secondary education and on the college level. Is it working well? It sounds like you're talking about kids coming in with ideally a bit of critical thinking or understanding what critical thinking and a theory of learning is about to some degree. But do you find that there's less of a? That's to me as you talked a little about in the book and the prologue and elsewhere. That's also what a liberal arts college is or was or should be, right? An ability to explore what it is that's interesting and learning itself as opposed to getting a job,
And I think it does work, but what I've observed happening is that after the first year or so, the students start to relax and really become invested in subjects and the whole process, and then by the time they're seniors, then the anxiety about jobs and what's going to happen next clamps down on them, and it's not that they stop learning, but suddenly that's overwhelming again. And it's partly the time we live in. When I graduated from college, I had all my friends looked around and said, oh yeah, we can make a living, and you could pick up the newspaper and find something to do and just sort of make your way, and it's a lot harder now. So yeah. I think that explains a lot of what happened. But obviously, we don't need to talk about how expensive it is and how many people it leaves out. I really do think that high school should be an adequate education, that people should come out of there with sort of what the basic things they need to start off in life, to be able to make some sort of philosophical inquiry and to be able to tell truth from fiction and things like that. And I think we could do a lot better with what we teach.
So let's talk a little more about your book, In Missing History, about the Covert Education of a Child of the Great Books, which is yourself, of course. In terms of writing this book, I was going to ask you to talk about the still life with caged lion, chapter 7, which is kind of what we're getting into right now, a little bit of kind of post-educational experience. But you could pick up anywhere in the book. We can even either talk about that, or is there something else in the book that you've reflected on more since you've written it and find particularly appropriate to discuss in the context of your book? It could be any chapter or that one.
No, go ahead and ask about that chapter. That's fine.
So that chapter, yeah. I mean, in talking about that, you were talking about your experience in Boston and what it meant to as we were just kind of discussing, in a way, continue education and enter into the workplace. So I guess my question about that chapter is, how is it that you feel looking back on that chapter in terms of the decisions you made then? And you know, you're referencing so many books and things you went through, and this is of course before the chapter of the Holy Grail. Did you do that made you feel that helped with that transition? And you talk about that in the chapter, of course, but maybe you could just talk a little bit about that now, that transition out of school and in Boston and not realizing that your education didn't prepare you to wash dishes or clean cat boxes or all these other things that
I guess as a preamble to that, so I'd graduated from college and I did work in a deli and do what I ended up cleaning cat boxes and things. But so like many people, I said, oh, I think I'll go to graduate school. So I applied to Johns Hopkins and went to the writing program there, which was a year, and got an MA. And then I moved to Boston and I first worked as a temporary typist for a patent attorney, and I remember typing over. There wasn't a word processor, so you really had to type these things over and over a patent application for an automatic ear piercer. And it was pretty gross that I typed that about 20 times. And I would walk every day from my apartment past the offices of Little Brown, and I would look in enviously at all the books and everything. And then I went into their human resources one day, and they had an opening, so I got a job working for a guy there who was the paperback manager at the time, and then he was promoted to a senior editor, and I went along as his assistant. But I remember when I first got this job, I had come out of grad school where we'd been given dire warnings, I guess, about what the publishing world was like and very little that was really good or adventurous could get published. So my first job at Little Brown was being the reader of the slush pile and the unsolicited manuscripts. And at the time, Little Brown had a fictitious editor named Sandra Thomas, who had to answer all these letters. And I don't know if this was some sort of genteel tradition of wanting people to think that we actually read everything they sent or what. But anyway, we had to individually sort of type these letters and sign them. And I was very surprised to discover, as I write in the book, that not all of these people were misunderstood geniuses. And I don't know if I can find it right now, but there were some wonderful lines that I saved from letters that came at the time, one of which was X, the name of the book, is about dead Indians who did not understand their predicament, or this is a nice one. In the book, I describe myself as an angry young man of 27 with sufficient reason to be angry, or so I felt. This letter is to inquire if you would be interested in hearing about Sylvia, a person sustained by a secret anger which she has sublimated into a working philosophy. While all of the characters are wholly fictional, the parrot January is actually a combination of three parrots I have known. So I won't keep going on, but anyway, it was, it was a great experience for me, and I loved the work atmosphere of it. I think more than any other job I've done, because it was sort of it was erudite, but also lively and connected to the world in a way that academia isn't and doesn't have the stuffiness of academia and the self-importance of academia that it can have. And so it was actually a really helpful education in seeing how the world of publishing worked and versus being in the academy. And the end of the chapter, if you'd like me to talk about that, was this moment when I went to visit a teacher of mine from graduate school, Joseph McElroy, who was in residence at the Lawrence Ranch in Taos, New Mexico, and we were walking around, and he's a writer who is, people have described him as the least known postmodernist, or the director of the writing seminars at Johns Hopkins called him the best unknown writer in America. And he's a very, very interesting, complex writer who's not ever gotten, you know, the attention he should have had, and was somebody I admired a lot and a wonderful critic for me of my own work. And so we'd become friends, and I went to visit him, and he said, "I want to show you something." So we went out in the woods and looked around, and there was a caretaker there who was this very irascible guy, so we're careful that he wouldn't see us. And Joe showed me that there was a wounded mountain lion in a cage. And so this is at the Lawrence Ranch, with all of the metaphors one can think that D.H. Lawrence might apply to a wounded mountain lion in a cage. And Joe and I, these two American writers, just kind of standing outside of it, looking at it, wondering, like, what to do about it? Should we report it? You know, what should we do? And so I that's why I called the chapter still Life with Caged Lion, because it seems just such a great metaphor of a problem writers can encounter, of something sort of wild and caged that you feel like you want to get out, but you can't and don't know how or what will happen to you if you do. So I don't know if that gets at your interest in that chapter, but that's sort of what I remember from it.
Yeah, and I think that is, I'm glad you spoke about that specific image. One other thing I want to ask is just in terms of education now and what's happening. I mean, I suppose there's a lot of different people listening to this, artists, writers, curators. How do you feel, you know, especially in this day and age and in this administration, we can somehow, I mean, besides reading your book, which I think is important, and there's, of course, a link to this in the essay, how can people help the situation or encourage the type of education you're talking about, curiosity perhaps even among themselves as well as their children to contribute, you know, or to resist in a way the tendency of where education is going. Is there something we can do or should do, suggest
well,
to do?
It's an interesting question at this moment in time, because all around us, I think, are people asking the question as we find ourselves in a time more polarized than most of us remember in our lifetimes, politically polarized, and trying to figure out how do we talk to somebody that we don't agree with, and how do we get out of these stuck places that we are, both in our own opinions and in thinking about other people's opinions. And I think, I mean, leaving aside the fact that we're so hampered by the difficulty of getting really correct, reliable information about what's going on outside of our immediate sphere, I think that we really need to practice negative capability, what Keats called this the ability to rest with having two opposite ideas in mind or uncertainty. I think we're so trained to want to make an absolute of something that we think. And I this is something I was writing about in the book, sort of aiming at with the idea that Western thinking, Western education is all about sort of reaching this moment of apotheosis, of final knowledge, that I think it's hard to resist that, but I think that's what we need to do, is just try to resist that, try to find out what we can, and you can't always say, I don't know about everything, but you need to think about the fact that you can't know everything, and that, you know, we need to approach each other with the same kind of curiosity and interest that we do a book or the world around us. And I think, you know, it's easy for me to say that. It's very hard to do that, I think.
I think so, too. I think also what you're saying, and, you know, as I've talked to recently other people about in interviews, in terms of education, it's becoming harder and harder, especially with social media and so much spreading visually before we even have a chance to read, to also investigate what's the truth of the matter in many cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So we all end up quoting people, and neither of us knows which source is reliable or how to go about finding if it's reliable, and I think that is an enormous problem.
I think so, too. Well, it's been great talking to you about your book. Before I ask you the last question, is there anything else you want to say about your book to people who are thinking about picking it up or reading more about what we're discussing?
I can't think of anything except that I just would say, I mean, I've had some responses from people, and what's been most gratifying to me really is not just people. I dedicated it to other children of the great books that I grew up with, and so I hear from them, but to hear from people who had a very different kind of background and saying that some of what I wrote about resonated with them was very comforting and made me very happy. So I guess I would just say that.
I want to ask you the question that I ask everybody at the end, which is, and it could be off topic or not, but what is it that you're reading at the moment?
Well, I'm reading a lot of different things. I recently discovered an English writer named Beverly Nichols, whose books I've been devouring. It's very hard to describe him. He writes about gardens and houses, and we found this book by him in a library sale in Maine this summer. And so I read that, and I've recommended him to a lot of people who've also liked him. And I think it's something in the voice and the tone that's so likable. I just started reading a book called Dark Money by Jane Mayer, a New Yorker writer, which is about how all the fortunes are controlling American politics. So the garden books are sort of an antidote to that book. And then I'm reading a book called The Vermont Tradition by Dorothy Canfield Fisher, which is to read about early settler accounts for a book of my own that I'm working on. So, yeah, there's probably a bigger pile if you want me to go on, but those are the main things.
And that's okay, but then that leads to then maybe one more question, which is you're currently working on another book right now. Do you want to say anything about what that is or what you're researching?
Sure. No, that book is a book. It's called The Rise and Fall of the Republic of West Delphi, and it's about the town I live in Vermont, and it's sort of about Vermont in general, but it's specifically about a time in the life of the village when a lot of people had moved up here from elsewhere, and it was a very sort of heady moment, and we had our own army and navy and gave ourselves positions in it and so on. And then at some point it sort of all fell apart. And so the book is really about that time period, but looking at it, it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek approach, but it's really, its intent is serious, to look at why when we have any sort of sense of belonging, it always has to come along with making somebody else not belong, so that to feel so excited that we were part of this group, we had to make ourselves be kind of an entity unto itself that meant that everybody else was not part of us. And so I'm interested in that in a large scale way. So
that sounds very interesting in a book that's appropriate to our times.
Yeah.
Catherine, I look forward to hearing about that book, and I also just want to thank you for talking with me today and for writing Missing History. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.